From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette, and you're listening to Idaho Matters. Well, it's Friday. Thank goodness. It has felt like a very long week for myself. I hope it's been fast for the rest of you. But since it is Friday, that means it is time for our reporter roundtable. And this is when we get you up to date on all of the news that made headlines this week. Today, our panel includes Dawn Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, our very own James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News, Will Walkie, reporter for the Mountain West News Bureau, as well as Wyoming Public Media, and Caleb Bradall, KUNR's Mountain West News Bureau reporter. Happy Friday, everybody.
Hey, happy Friday.
Hey, happy Friday.
Okay, so I want to start with the legislature. A lot happened at the State House this week. So, Jimmy, you have been there. You've been covering all of it. Can we start with a bill to not allow trans youth to access gender-affirming health care? Tell us what this bill is and now what the very latest is.
Yeah, so this bill would essentially make it a felony for any doctor who prescribes puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, or who performs sex reassignment surgery on a transgender patient under 18. We should say from the very top that no doctor is performing sex reassignment surgeries on minors in the state of Idaho, which the bill sponsor, Bruce Skog, admitted on the floor when the House debated that earlier this week. And that kind of leads into exactly where the bill is. So the House passed it. 58 out of the 59 Republicans voted for it, with one joining all the Democrats and opposing it. Basically, you know, they're arguing that these children are too young to be making these decisions, and that even though they support parental rights to make individual healthcare decisions for their own families, this is something that parents should not have the option to do. Even though, you know, the research shows that the earlier that a trans youth does get access to these care or, you know, forms of health care, if they choose to undergo them, that they are associated with better health outcomes, you know, less depression, less anxiety, and less, you know, suicidal thoughts. So this now goes to the Senate. You know, it wasn't really a surprise that this happened, since the House passed a similar bill last year. But what's really going to, you know, mark the future of this is whether or not a Senate committee actually takes this up, because last year the Senate chose not to.
Mm-hmm. So, Jimmy, I'm curious if you know about the wording in this bill, and does it specifically say trans youth? And the reason why I ask this question is that there's been conversations around what gender affirming care is, because there are children who are not transgender who get gender-affirming care. There are numerous boys who are prepubescent or in puberty who take hormones because they are, you know, they are not growing at the rate that they, you know, I guess societally should be growing. So doctors prescribe hormones for these boys to grow taller.
Right.
Is this just focused on trans youth, or is this gender affirming care, if that makes sense?
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying, and it's an important distinction to make. So yes, there are exceptions under this bill for, you know, those who are born intersex, for example, where, you know, a child might be born with both sets of genitalia or some combination of the two, right? You know, that does happen. It's somewhat rare, but not super infrequent. And then it does make an exception for, you know, anyone who does need those hormones for, you know, some sort of, like you mentioned, any kind of growth condition that they might be undergoing, or if you have precocious puberty, where you know, you start puberty for girls like at 8 or 9 years old, super young, just to kind of put a pause on that. So there are those exceptions. It's basically saying the wording is something, I don't have it in front of me, but something to the effect of to quote change, you know, someone's biological sex to the other, essentially.
Okay, I appreciate that clarification. Dawn, I want to bring you into the conversation, because another big story that happened this week is a petition to dissolve the Meridian Library District. What's going on in terms of why did we get this far? But I guess what happens next and who decides this? Oh, Don, you're muted.
Hi, how are you?
There you go. We can hear you now.
I'm having one of those days, friends.
You know, Don, me too. It's just a Friday.
It is. So anybody who has been listening to Idaho Matters or reading Boise Dev for a while knows that there are a group of residents in Meridian who are upset about some of the approaches that the Meridian Library is taking in regards to some of the content it stocks. This is not uncommon. Libraries across the country are seeing these issues where folks generally on the right are upset with things that they see in the libraries. Mm-hmm. For Meridian, this group of citizens, they call themselves the Concerned Citizens of Meridian, had testified that they were placing, quote, pornographic books in the children's section, and they requested those be removed. One book in particular that they have referenced a number of times is a graphic novel called Gender Queer. It explores gender identity and sexuality. I'm choosing my words super carefully here. I'm actually reading mm-hmm. from Autumn Robertson's story because I think it's important to understand that these people are making some specific claims, and I think people should go and read our story and look at the actual book that they're referencing. You know, I don't make a judgment either way on whether it's correct or not. I think people should make those decisions themselves. But what they've done now is they have petitioned to the county. They have amassed about 100 signatures to ask the county to dissolve the library district. And to do that, the state of Idaho requires a 50 signature threshold. They turned in about 119 signatures. This went to the county commission. And from there, a whole process is going to go forward. If the county commission determines that there are enough signatures that are valid, they would hold a hearing. And I should say that they have done that. They have verified that there are 50 signatures. They could hold a hearing in 3 to 6 weeks, and then they would make a notification to the library district. After that, they could put forth an order, and they would then have the choice of whether or not to ask the county clerk to hold an election for the patrons of the Meridian Library District. It's important to note that the Meridian Library District is not the city of Meridian. It is separate. Okay. In Boise, the libraries are part of the city of Boise. In Meridian, it's a separate taxing district. And I believe that the boundaries are a little different than the city of Meridian. If it goes to voters, voters will have the choice. They can say, yeah, we want to dissolve the district, or no, we don't. If they do choose to dissolve the district, then the Ada County Board of Commission would make some decisions on what to do with the current property. And so they have a couple of library facilities. They're working on another. They have the books and all the staff and all of those things. This isn't going to be a quick process, and voters are going to get a say. Voters in the Meridian Library District, if the county commission decides that this is valid and can move forward, they're going to get to decide at the ballot box if this should be dissolved or not. And we'll see. I mean, I honestly, I wouldn't make a prognostication on whether or not that will go one way or the other. But that's kind of where we are, and that's the process and where we are right now.
Okay. So, Don, if I'm understanding this correctly, let's say that this gets to a vote and they vote to dissolve. That means the libraries in Meridian literally go away?
Yeah, and that's not necessarily the case. It would basically put it to the Ada County Board of Commissioners, the Ada County Commission, to make some decisions on what would happen. Debt would need to be paid off. There are physical buildings. They're actually working on a new library at the Orchard Park development at Shinden and Linder. So the road ahead is still a little unclear, even if the voters out there say they want to dissolve this. That certainly is a possible outcome, but we're not far enough along in the process to fully understand all the ins and outs of what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Again, this has to get through a bunch of hurdles before it's even on the ballot. If it gets on the ballot, you know, what are the citizens of the Meridian Library District going to say? Maybe they'll come out in force and say, no, we want libraries. We don't know. We just don't know. If we get to that point, then the county commission will continue to play a role.
Okay. And Jimmy, the House, heading back to the state House, the House has introduced an anti-porn library bill. So can you explain what this is?
Yeah, I mean, this is all part and parcel of the same movement of mostly far-right activists who say that these books that contain, you know, largely contain LGBTQ, you know, themes or some sexual content, some of which is significant, some of which, you know, others might say is pretty minimal compared to other books, but that they're not appropriate for children. So this has been something that's been going on for more than a year now. Last year, the House tried to, they voted for criminalizing the lending of these materials to minors, which didn't go anywhere in the Senate. So this year, instead of making it a criminal offense, they would allow parents whose children were allowed to check out these books without their permission to sue a school district or a public library, depending on where they got the material. And they could get, you know, up to $10,000 per instance of, you know, their child checking out these books or movies or songs or, you know, whatever it might be from the library. So that bill was introduced. We're still waiting for a public hearing on that before it goes to the full House if it passes out of committee.
You know, I find that interesting, Jimmy, because as a parent to minors, both of my children have library cards. I have to sign off on those. They can't have a library card without me signing off on it and giving them permission to go to the library and check out library books. So has that come up in discussion at all? I mean, maybe I'm looking at this in a different way, but when I'm signing off giving them a library card, I'm signing off on allowing them to check things out of the library.
Yeah, it has. I mean, I was at a Meridian Library District meeting last year toward summer when, you know, these concerned citizens of Meridian were, you know, testifying that, hey, please put these books where kids can't get them, at least if you're not going to pull them. You know, they say that, okay, whatever, if parents want to sign off on it, I guess that's fine, or at least some of them did. But others were just like, no, get these books out of the library. But of course, folks with the library system and people who supported them say like that's restricting First Amendment rights. But we did see, you know, a CUNA school district, for example, took, I think, about 25 books and put them on their behind the counter policy or whatever, where kids can see them. They can see that they are able to be checked out, but they just need their parents to sign off on, you know, checking out those books. So, I mean, it's certainly something that's come up as an argument for sure.
Okay. But before we head to a break, Jimmy, I want to talk about one more thing at the legislature. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this bill was introduced yesterday. And this is making it a misdemeanor if you administer an mRNA vaccine. So things like the Pfizer or the Moderna COVID vaccine would be in that what's the word I'm looking for?
Definition. That category. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, so that was introduced Wednesday. So this was from Senator Tammy Nichols, who has been, you know, kind of an anti-vaccination supporter for a few years now. And, you know, this, yeah, it's administering an mRNA vaccine to any person or mammal. So that would include any kind of livestock like horses or cows or, you know, goats, sheep, whatever. I guess the concern is that it could potentially enter the food system, though, you know, I've seen several, you know, fact-checking articles from national publications saying, no, that doesn't really happen. And also the USDA requires that, you know, farmers and ranchers wait, I think it's 60 days after administering vaccines to any livestock before selling any of the products or meat on the market. Mm. And by that time, their bodies would have metabolized any sort of vaccine, mRNA or not. So, I mean, it's you know, certainly a bill that is going to get some consideration. I can't say whether or not it will get much traction, because you do have those more agriculturally minded legislators there at the state house who, you know, might see this as an infringement on like ranchers' rights.
So, Don, there's some big news coming out of Micron, and we are learning that they plan to significantly reduce their workforce. Can you get us up to date on this?
Hey-o, we got to give credit to Boise State Public Radio's Troy Oppie, who actually broke this story. And so we are following your reporting. So I feel awkward talking about that on your air. So I want to just make sure people know that Troy dug this up, not the Wall Street Journal or Reuters or Boise Dev, but Troy Oppie. So congrats to him. But what's happening here is late last fall, Micron Technology said that it would lay off 10% of its workforce. They saw their profits swing to a loss and quickly made a whole raft of changes, including cutting benefits and some others, bonuses and some others. Mm-hmm. What Troy found out and we were able to confirm is that Micron this week told employees that it was actually going to up that workforce cut from 10% of all workers to 15%. Micron employs about 48,000 people worldwide. So quick math shows that's about 7,200 folks who will lose their jobs either through a layoff or by attrition, meaning that they leave the company and their position isn't filled through the end of this year. We don't fully know the impact here in the Boise Valley. We believe, according to Idaho Department of Labor stats, that Micron employs about 5,000 people here in Idaho. If you take that 15% and you apply it to 5,000, that gets you 750 jobs. But I think it's important to say that Micron hasn't said that it's going to be even, right? That it's not going to happen the same everywhere. And in fact, Erica Rodriguez-Pompon, a spokesperson of the company, told me that some organizations and regions will see higher reductions than the company average, while others will be lower. I don't want to put too much on that, but I would say the fact that she told a Boise news outlet that indicates that maybe it will not be that 750 number, but we just don't know at this point. And so, you know, if you've been around a while, you know that Micron and the semiconductor industry at large, it kind of goes boom and bust a little bit. It's a very much a supply and demand driven business. Coming out of the pandemic, the supply of chips was low and the demand was really high. And then chip makers ramped up and probably ramped up a little too much. And now they've got too much inventory and not enough demand to fill it. The elephant in the room here that I know everybody listening is wondering is, well, okay, what about that $15 billion expansion that the company has planned out there? What I can tell you from our reporting is that still appears to be moving forward. The company won approval from the city of Boise for that project, the largest in city's history by a factor of like 30, if not more. We won approval from that. On that last fall, and the company has been filing dozens of permits for electrical, plumbing, some building permits. They held a groundbreaking about 3 or 4 weeks ago on a water renewal project. Idaho Power is also doing some work out there, and that seems to be progressing. That's a longer term play, and is something that the company said would roll out between now and 2030. Even though time goes fast and that's only 7 years, I do think that we'll still see that move along. Micron said that could mean as many as 7,000 new jobs here in the Treasure Valley. So long-term prognosis for Micron is probably a fairly significant increase in positions here in the Valley. But the short-term impact, you know, they're trying to catch up with their profitability and they're cutting workers. So the way I tell people to think about it is it's kind of two tracks. You have the now and you have the long-term. The now is definitely a cloudy picture for the company, but the long-term net out is they're going to keep working to expand.
Okay. Jimmy, I know you need to leave here in a couple of minutes, so I want to get to another big story from the State House before you leave us. And this is the issue of school choice or school vouchers, ESAs, whatever it's being called. But there's a bill that's advanced in the State House, and there has been some public testimony on this. So can you tell us about this bill, the public testimony, but then what happens next with it?
Sure. Yeah. A lot of public testimony over a couple days. We're talking like four and a half hours of public testimony in the Senate Education Committee. So this particular piece of legislation would create education savings accounts, which would then use money that would normally go to public schools and, you know, essentially let parents choose where to spend that, whether it's for private school tuition, which is why some opponents basically call it a voucher system. But parents could also use it for things like homeschooling materials, think curriculum, or tutoring services, for example. The only catch is that, you know, their student wouldn't be able to attend public school. You can't double dip. And so, you know, this has been really the dream of a lot of more libertarian or more conservative members of the Republican Party here in Idaho for several years now, probably even decades. I know the movement has been around for a while nationwide. But so we heard from nearly 100 people, I would say, over these 2 days. You know, opposition was the majority of them, but it wasn't, you know, super overwhelming, I would say. There were a lot of people who were supportive of this, you know, pointing to Idaho public schools, you know, fairly low test scores, and that they don't want their kids trapped in these schools, while opponents of this say, okay, that's great and all, but if you live in a pretty rural area, there's really not any private schools that they could use to you know, pay tuition with this money. So it's one of those issues that certainly has gotten a lot of publicity, a lot of talk, and it eventually did pass out of the Senate Education Committee. I would say the other piece of this bill that kind of got more moderate Republicans and Democrats concerned, I guess, is that there's really not any sort of accountability factored into this, because the State Department of Education isn't really allowed to track test scores, from homeschooled students or you know, private schools. They don't have to submit those to the DOE, whereas public schools do. So it's just like the ultimate check, I guess, on accountability would be with the parents, is what supporters say. And they would be the ones to decide whether or not these programs or whatever they pay for with this money, whether it's worth it and actually educating their kids.
So, Jimmy, I know that your child cannot be enrolled in a public school if this goes through, right? And we're talking around $6,000 per K through 12 student. So what about things like charter schools? Because they're under the umbrella of public schools, but could you choose that? And I also, what I find interesting about this as well is people complain about the public school system and the test scores not being good, et cetera, et cetera. Yet if you want to hire a tutor for your child, then you have to take them out of the public school system in order to do that. And, you know, so on the flip side of that, then, is this idea that, all right, so you're just giving a tax break to those who can already afford to send their children to these private schools.
That's certainly an argument. And I missed the first part of your question. Did you say, would charter schools also be included?
Are charter schools included in, I mean, could your child be in a charter school and get these funds? Or is it because they're under the umbrella of public schools?
Yeah, no, they would not be able to do that since they are classified as public schools already. The argument that's, okay, well, if you're going to private school or if you're homeschooling and you know, you want to take advantage of these tutoring services, there's certainly that argument that, okay, well, you're already paying for private school tuition. And this, we should say that, like, you know, this $6,000, while it may cover, you know, the full amount of tuition for Some schools in the Treasure Valley,
you know, cover at least most.
Yeah, I was going to say at least a lot of them that I've seen, tuition is more like $8,000, $9,000 per year or higher. So it's not going to cover the entire cost of that. Certainly would defray a lot. That point got brought up over and over again by opponents saying that, this money is going to, put our public schools in a worse situation by, you know, pulling that money out of it, but also that this is really only going to help those with private means anyway. Mm-hmm. Although right. We heard from plenty of people who were not, you know, said they weren't wealthy anyway, and that they would love to send their child to a private school if this passed.
Well, I think it's going to be interesting to follow. So, Jimmy, I appreciate the update. I know you have to leave us, so appreciate your time today. Caleb, I want to bring you into the conversation because you have done some reporting around warming trends in the Mountain West and some pretty concerning numbers in regards to winter time. So can you explain this?
Yeah, for sure. Also, thanks for having me. Absolutely. Obviously, we've had a lot of cold snaps across the Mountain West, a lot of snow. I'm in Reno, Nevada, and we've had multiple snowstorms. I think we're supposed to get another one next week. But despite all that, there's been a lot of warming and lack of freezing nights over the past 50-some years. A group called Climate Central, they kind of analyzed the number of coldest nights each year from 1970 to 2022. And Reno, where I'm at, has actually seen the largest decline in freezing nights in the nation since 1970. Mm. The annual number of freezing nights here in Reno has decreased by 91, which is obviously concerning. Wow. And then we've had some other big dips across the Mountain West region. Ranking second is Albuquerque. They've seen 45 fewer nights. And then some other notable ones, Helena, Montana has seen 30 fewer, and then Boise has seen 16 fewer. So it's a trend that's not only affecting our region, but across the entire country. So I talked to the Nevada state climatologist to kind of talk about kind of how there are some pros and cons to this. She said some of the pros, it obviously reduces heating costs and risks to vulnerable people, especially at night. But it also raises plenty of concerns, such as snowpack in the mountains melting faster, which can impact water supplies. And then also it hurts farmers' crops because a lack of winter cold can sometimes allow insect populations to grow, resulting in more harm to their crops in the spring and summer. So it's more bad news than good, essentially.
Yeah, those numbers are higher than I would have thought. I appreciate that reporting on that, Caleb. So Will, talk to us about how grizzly bears may lose federal protection. Now, is this just in the Mountain West? And why is this potentially happening?
Sure. So really complicated issue here, but there are sort of two efforts, I guess you could say, to remove grizzly bear protections in parts of the Northern Rockies, and specifically around the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, massive area covering Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho, and also a separate ecosystem in northern Montana. And so the Fish and Wildlife Service, and they've done this twice before since 2005, but they announced earlier this month that they will be conducting a review of grizzly bears in those two areas, the greater Yellowstone ecosystem and northern Montana, to try and see if they can remove them from the endangered species list. And at the same time, five senators, including both from Idaho, both from my home state of Wyoming, and one from Montana, introduced a bill yesterday nationally to try and remove grizzly bears in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem from the endangered species list. So the question, why do they want to do this, right? And the answer is, from the point of view of lawmakers here in the Northern Rockies, in Idaho and Wyoming and Montana, grizzly bears have recovered. Their numbers have gotten so good in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, for instance, that they feel states should be managing them. And what might happen if they lose federal protections? Well, states would manage them in the ways that they want. And that would differ from the federal government for sure. We don't know for sure what states might want to do, but for instance, livestock managers might have greater protections and abilities to protect their livelihoods and their cattle from grizzly bears. Also, there might be things like hunting, which is a really controversial topic around grizzly bears. And so these fights have been happening for decades in the Northern Rockies and, you know, both in Washington and in state houses. But this is just the latest chapter in that. And it's fair to say this is going to be happening for years to come.
Yeah, I think you're right on that. So Dawn, I know we've talked numerous times on this program about the need for affordable housing. You and your team have written in depth about this issue. So I'm curious about what's going on in downtown Boise, because there's some affordable housing that's going to be torn down soon.
Bit of this, I would say, throughout the city and not just in Boise, but beyond. There is a fairly small apartment complex along River Street that currently has 16 little apartments. I should say little, but apartments. The buildings are fairly small. This is going to be redeveloped. The Boise City Council gave approval to redo this, to tear down the 16 fourplexes, the 16 units across some fourplexes, and build a larger apartment building with 130 units. It would have two stories of parking, the garage, some ground floor commercial space. The people living in the apartments right now are going to get some help finding a new place to live, but they're not going to be given any cash to pay the difference between old and new rent, which has happened in a couple of other similar cases here. The developer of the project is a local firm called DeChase Mixis. They are working with the Capital City Development Corporation, which is the city's urban renewal agency, to help make 13 of the units affordable for 4 years. And affordable, a little different definition depending on who you ask, but essentially it's going to give them the ability to rent those units to people making 100% of the area median income or below. Right now, that means about $61,000 for a single adult in the market. And the formula would mean rent of about $1,500 a month. I know a lot of your listeners will go, $1,500 a month is not affordable. And all I can tell you is that is what the federal calculation is for an affordable rent. And so, you know, I hear that and we get that a lot from people. I don't know the rent on the current units, but I believe it to be quite a bit lower than that. And the people who are living in them are not guaranteed a spot in one of the new units. Obviously, the buildings have to be torn down for the new building to be built. So you couldn't just move from one to the other. We're going to see probably more of this as the city continues to become more dense in coming years. One thing we hear a lot is it feels like apartments are being built on every available piece of land. And I don't think that that's fully untrue, that we are needing a lot more housing in the city of Boise, whether that's new homes, whether that's apartments, and whether it's in Meridian, Nampa, Caldwell. And developers are certainly working to find ways to add housing, both because it's needed and because it's profitable.
Yeah. So I only have about 2 minutes left. And so, Will, I quickly would love for you to tell us about what you found out in terms of conservation here in the Mountain West, in particular in regards to overcrowding, but the fact that people still want land preserved.
Yeah, thanks. So Colorado College does a poll basically every year, a really comprehensive poll about conservation in the West. They interview thousands of people across eight Mountain West states, including Idaho, ask them their feelings about, for instance, the Biden administration's goal to preserve 30% of U.S. lands and waters by 2030. And what they found this year was interesting in that the priorities and the concerns about Mountain West residents are changing. So, for instance, people are really concerned about inflation, not a surprise. They also found that since 2016, so 7 years ago, more than double the amount of respondents are concerned that too many people are moving into their state. Again, not surprising in a state like Idaho, where there's so much population growth. But despite those recent priority shifts, you know, people are still in the Mountain West really concerned about conservation, and they're really concerned about climate change and water, and they still want to see government action, for instance, on creating new national monuments to create more outdoor space. They still want to see the transition away from fossil fuels and towards renewable energy, you know, and that's something that I wasn't necessarily expecting given people's concerns over energy costs. And so I think it shows that no matter what is happening in the Mountain West and how many changes we're seeing, people here still love their wildlife. They still love their region, and they want to see it stay the same in terms of the values that they love.
Well, I want to thank all of you so much for your time today. We've been talking with Don Day with Boise Dev, James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio, Will Walkie with the Mountain West News Bureau, and Kayla Bradall with KUNR's Mountain West News Bureau as well. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Race might be a hot topic right now, but for so many of us, talking about race is nothing new. On the Code Switch podcast from NPR, we go beyond the headlines and we go deep. Listen now.